Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're diving into a topic that's really close to my heart, Viking braids, Norse braided hairstyles, and above all the question, what do we actually really know about them?
And that's exactly the fascinating question. Because when you look around at medieval fairs, on the internet, on social media, you see these elaborate braided hairstyles in Viking style everywhere. It's become a real trend.
And that didn't happen by accident. I've been watching this develop in the scene for several years now. LARP, reenactment, cosplay. There was a very clear turning point. And that was 2013, when the series Vikings premiered on the History Channel. Before that, Viking hairstyles were a niche topic. People in the scene knew about them, but in the mainstream? Barely on anyone's radar. And then Ragnar Lothbrok showed up with his iconic braids and shaved sides. And suddenly everyone wanted to look like that.
And then The Last Kingdom came along in 2015.
The Last Kingdom, Vikings Valhalla on Netflix, endless YouTube tutorials, Instagram, TikTok. It snowballed from there. At the fairs I go to, there are now stalls offering hands-on braiding sessions. 10 years ago, that simply wasn't a thing.
And I think that's great. First of all, because it draws people into history. Men and women wear these braids. And both genders historically paid attention to hair care. That's well documented. Did men also wear braids? Plausible, but honestly, there's very little solid evidence for it. But here comes the big but.
And the but is, how much of this is actually historically documented? And how much is, well, Hollywood?
And that's where things get thin, honestly. The available sources on specific Viking hairstyles are much sparser than most people think. We have archaeological finds, of course. We have a few written sources, a few visual depictions. But when you look at what's actually reliable among those,
what we do know with reasonable certainty is that hair care was extremely important to the Vikings. The archaeological finds speak volumes on that front. In Hedeby alone, practically in our backyard here in Schleswig-Holstein, around 1,250 combs or comb fragments have been found. They're among the most common personal small finds from the Viking Age. Only tools and textile production artifacts are found more frequently.
So that means we know they took intensive care of their
hair, yes. And these weren't simple little things. They were elaborately crafted composite combs made from reindeer antler, often with fine teeth on one side and coarser ones on the other. The fine teeth were probably also used for delousing, but the coarse ones were for detangling and styling. This was genuine everyday culture.
And then, of course, we have Ibn Fadlan, the Arab diplomat who visited the Rus Vikings on the Volga in 921 or 922. He describes in great detail how they washed and combed themselves every morning, face, hands, hair, including a shared wash basin. That's a direct primary source.
But he doesn't describe any specific hairstyles. He doesn't say they had a fishtail braid or an undercut.
And that's the point. We have John of Wallingford, an English chronicler from the 13th century, who confirms that the Danes combed their hair daily and bathed regularly. We have Viking Age picture stones from Gotland, for example, that show figures with structures in the hair that could suggest hairstyles. but whether those are braids, stylized depictions, or simply the way the stonemason rendered hair, that can't be said with any certainty.
There's also the Hårby Valkyrie figure from Denmark, a small silver figurine showing a woman with a kind of knotted or braided hairstyle. That's one of the better pieces of evidence for more elaborate hair arrangements. But even there, it's one figurine, and the interpretation of the exact type of hairstyle isn't clear-cut.
So, let's sum up where we stand. Hair care was demonstrably important to the Vikings. The comb finds, the written sources, that's archaeologically solid. That both men and women wore various hairstyles, there are indications, but the evidence is limited. The specific braiding patterns we sell today as typically Viking, the triple braid, the fishtail look, those elaborate combinations,
those come largely from modern popular culture. That doesn't mean they couldn't have existed. Braiding is an ancient technique found in virtually every culture. And if you have combs and you take care of your hair, then it stands to reason that you'd also braid it or tie it up in some way. But the specific styles we see today are more modern interpretations than historically verified reconstructions.
And I actually think that's a really exciting starting point for this episode. What we want to do today is exactly that. Separate what's documented from what's plausible and what's pure fantasy. Because both have their place, but you shouldn't mix them up.
And at the same time, even if the specific braiding patterns are modern interpretations, the foundation is historical. The Vikings took care of their hair. They put jewelry in it, beads, metal rings. It was part of their identity. And the fascination we feel for it today doesn't come out of nowhere.
That's a good point. Let's take a look at what archaeology can really tell us and where its limits lie. So let's look at what the sources actually give us. And I'm not talking about blogs or YouTube videos here, but the archaeological finds and the few written sources we have. And it starts with the fact that the clearest proof of the importance of hair care among the Vikings doesn't come from a text, but from the graves themselves.
Let's stick with the combs. They're not just a mass find in Hedeby. They're also among the absolute most common personal grave goods in burial sites. This pattern runs through all of Scandinavia, from Birka in Sweden to Hedeby here in the north. They turn up in many graves, significantly more often than weapons, for instance, although the exact numbers vary considerably depending on the region and burial site.
And what many people don't realize, these weren't simple little wooden combs. The typical Viking combs were so-called composite combs, multiple plates of bone or antler held together with small rivets of bronze or iron. A really sophisticated construction. And more recent analyses show that the vast majority of antler finds in Hedeby, we're talking about roughly 90% of around 300,000 artifact pieces, came from reindeer whose antler was imported from northern Scandinavia via trade routes through Kaupang and Birka.
So, a trade commodity. The raw materials were transported over hundreds of kilometers just to make combs.
Among other things, yes. The biomolecular analyses have shown that quite clearly. The reindeer antler came from the Arctic, was then processed in Hedeby, where there were specialized comb-making workshops, and the combs often had teeth on both sides, coarse ones for detangling and fine ones that probably also served for delousing. Some were decorated with geometric patterns or knotwork.
What all of this tells us, hair care was so important to the Vikings that they engaged in long-distance trade for it. That's no small matter. But, and we have to be honest here, it tells us nothing about what the actual hairstyles looked like. A comb proves that you combed your hair. It doesn't prove whether you then braided a fishtail or wore your hair loose.
And that brings us back to the written sources. We already mentioned Ibn Fadlan, the Arab envoy who travelled to the Volga in 921 or... No, it was 922. Besides the washing, he also describes the ruse as tall, blonde to red-haired. What's also interesting, they carried saffron in small leather pouches as a fragrance, which shows how important a well-groomed appearance was to them.
That's a fascinating detail, because it shows how much value was placed on outward appearance. But here too, just as I mentioned before, he doesn't describe any specific hairstyles. He does, however, debunk another myth, or rather, he's silent on it. The idea of bleaching hair with lye actually comes from entirely different sources, Icelandic sagas from the 13th century. He describes physique, clothing, hygiene, but the hairstyles in detail, those are missing.
And of course, you also have to keep in mind that Ibn Fadlan was describing a very specific group, the Rus on the Volga, meaning East Scandinavian traders and warriors who
had already adapted heavily to their surroundings. You can't simply generalize that to all Vikings. A Norwegian farmer in the 9th century probably looked quite different from a Swedish long-distance trader on the Volga. That's often forgotten in popular portrayals. People act as if there was one single Viking look.
By the way, if you enjoy this kind of critical engagement with history, feel free to subscribe or recommend us to others. It helps us cover more topics like this.
But back to the visual sources. We briefly touched on the Gotland picture stones earlier. These large limestone steles from Sweden date from the 7th to the 11th century. They show warriors, ships, riders, mythological scenes. But if you look closely at the human figures, they're so heavily stylized that you simply can't draw any conclusions about hairstyles. The heads are schematic, the proportions are exaggerated.
They're not portraits, these are symbolic depictions. And the stonemason wanted to tell a story, not document how someone's hair looked.
Then there are the Osebek textiles, the tapestry fragments from the famous ship burial in Norway, dated to around 834. Those are also often cited as evidence. But they're so heavily fragmented that the depicted figures are barely recognizable. The archaeologists mainly see animals, wagons, ritual scenes. Whether the human figures are wearing any specific hairstyles, and what kind, simply can't be reliably reconstructed from the surviving remnants.
And we really need to take a closer look at the Horby Valkyrie that you mentioned earlier, because that's probably the best piece of evidence for elaborate hairstyles. A tiny silver figurine from around 800, only 3.4 centimeters tall, discovered in 2013 on the Danish island of Funen by a metal detectorist. Gilded silver with yellow inlays for the patterns on the dress. It shows a woman with a sword and shield, and her hair is gathered in a large knot.
And that's one of the very few three-dimensional depictions of a hairstyle from the Viking Age. Most other Valkyrie depictions are flat, on picture stones or brooches. The Horby figurine is dated to around the year 800, and clearly shows some kind of knotted hairstyle. But not a braided plait in the modern sense. And it's one figurine. You can't derive any universal conclusions about Viking hairstyles from it.
And that brings us to a point you often read in blog posts, that certain braiding patterns were supposedly associated with specific gods, or that the type of braid indicated your clan or your
family affiliation. That sounds plausible, and culturally it wouldn't be far-fetched. But there's simply no reliable archaeological or written evidence for it. These are assumptions that have taken on a life of their own. The sagas do mention hair and hairstyles, but in very general terms,
long hair as a sign of freedom, a well-groomed appearance as a virtue. A direct link between braiding patterns and god cults or clans is found nowhere.
What we can say with certainty, hair care held a high status for both men and women. The comb finds, the written sources, the few visual depictions, all of it points in the same direction. But between this established knowledge and what passes today as a typical Viking hairstyle, there's a pretty large interpretive gap.
And that's really the crux of the whole discussion. We know they took care of their hair. We know that hairstyles were socially significant. But exactly how they looked, that's where we fill in the gaps with our own imagination today. And that's perfectly fine, as long as you don't mistake it for established history. So now we know what the sources tell us and what they don't. But let's talk about the social aspect, because that's a point that truly fascinates me about this topic. Hair was clearly more than just aesthetics. And if we look at other cultures, communal hair braiding is a deeply social act. In West African cultures, among the Maori, among indigenous peoples of North America, we find it everywhere. It would almost be strange if Norse society of all places had not practiced it.
The blog post describes braiding among the Vikings as a communal activity where family members came together. That sounds plausible, and anthropologically it makes sense. But to be honest, we have no specific evidence for that from the Viking Age. There's no passage in the sagas that describes a family sitting together and braiding each other's hair.
What there are, though, are indirect clues. The sagas do describe hairstyles as something that shaped identity. In the Laxdöla saga, for example, Kjartan Olafsson is described as a man with a wealth of hair, silken soft, fair, and falling in curls. That's not a passing mention. It serves to define his character. Long, well-groomed hair signals nobility, strength, and lineage in the sagas.
And his father, Olafre Peacock, is described in almost identical terms. Long, silky hair falling in curls. That's a literary motif. But you have to keep in mind, the sagas were written down in the 13th century, two or three centuries after the Viking Age. They tell of events from the 10th century, filtered through a Christian Icelandic perspective. That doesn't mean everything was made up, but you have to be careful about
how literally you take it. The sagas are literary works, not reportage. And what I find interesting, in the Laxdöla saga, it's mainly men who are described through their hair. The saga's most famous female character, Gudrun, doesn't get a hair description at all.
Which stands in contrast to the popular notion that Viking women had the more elaborate hairstyles.
And that brings us to an important point. Gender roles among the Vikings were in some respects different from what you might think. Men and women wore hairstyles that underlined their social status. The archaeological finds, the combs, appear in men's and women's graves in equal measure. Hair care wasn't a gender-specific matter. And there's a well-known gaming piece made of walrus ivory from the 10th century, only 3 centimeters tall, found in a Norwegian fjord and now housed in the Danish National Museum, that shows a man with well-groomed hair and beard. Human depictions on Viking figurines are actually rare, by the way. Most were animal motifs. It was a status symbol, so a far cry from the wild Ragnar Lothbrok look that we associate with Vikings today.
Well-groomed hair and beard. Admittedly, that's not the wild image most people picture when they think of Vikings.
But that's exactly what shows how diverse it was. And it was probably very different from region to region. A Norwegian coastal dweller likely wore different hairstyles than a Danish warrior or a Swedish merchant in the East.
And as we briefly touched on earlier, there's the question of clan affiliation through braiding patterns. That's often
claimed. And culturally, it would certainly be conceivable. But we have no evidence for it. No saga, no archaeological find that specifically shows certain hairstyles were associated with certain families. It's an idea that sounds good, but isn't supported by the sources.
Where we really are on solid ground, though, is with hair accessories. And by that, I mainly mean the
beads. And here you have to make some distinctions. What archaeology has really documented in large quantities are glass beads. They've been found in great numbers at trading centers like Hedebu, Birka, and Kaupang. Some were imports, millefiori beads with complex patterns from the Islamic world or Frankish territories, while others were produced locally. They typically ranged from about 5 to 15 millimeters in size.
However, and this is an important caveat, these beads are predominantly interpreted in graves as necklace or chest jewelry. Classifying them as beard beads or hair beads in a strict sense is archaeologically difficult. Individual beads in men's graves could have been amulets, or they could have been beard or hair ornaments. But a clear identification often can't be derived from the find context.
What we do know. Glass beads are found more frequently in women's graves than in men's. The popular image of the bearded Viking with silver jewelry braided into his beard, that's modern. There are metal beads made of bronze and, rarely, silver, crafted with knot patterns or geometric decorations. But their specific use as beard jewelry is an interpretation, not a confirmed finding.
That's a good example of how reenactment and pop culture fill in the gaps. The finds exist. Beads, metal rings, pins. But whether they were worn exactly the way we do it in the scene today, that we don't know.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And that brings us to a question that naturally preoccupies me a lot as a reenactment enthusiast. How do we deal with this uncertainty? In the scene, there's this tension between creative expression and the pursuit of historical accuracy. And with hairstyles, it's particularly noticeable because the source material is so thin. Most people I know take the liberty of interpreting hairstyles. They use what's plausible as a guide, take the few pieces of evidence as a starting point, and then get creative.
And I think that's the right approach. As long as you're aware that you're interpreting, not reconstructing. A 100% historically documented Viking hairstyle, that simply doesn't exist. There are clues, there are plausibilities, and there's a lot of room for creative expression. What makes hairstyles so fascinating, though, is that despite all the uncertainty, they convey something real. The value that the Vikings placed on their appearance.
Now it gets practical. Because we've been talking this whole time about what's documented and what isn't, but the techniques themselves are universal. Braiding is braiding, whether it's the Viking Age or today.
And that's an important point. The basic technique, three strands alternating over each other, is as old as humanity itself. Even Venus figurines from the Paleolithic show braided hairstyles. Then Egyptian wall paintings, Minoan frescoes, Greek vase paintings. The three-strand braid has existed for millennia in virtually every culture. It's not a Viking-specific invention, even though it's marketed as a Viking braid today.
And yet, it's the logical starting point if you want to try your hand at Norse braided hairstyles. The principle is simple. divide your hair into three equal sections, then lay the right strand over the middle one, then the left over the new middle. Repeat until you reach the end and secure it all with a band. The typical beginner's mistake, by the way, is making the sections uneven. Then the braid comes out crooked and uneven.
And for preparation, what do you actually need?
A comb, hair ties, possibly hairpins for more complicated styles. The hair should be clean and well combed, ideally dry. Wet hair stretches and the braid ends up looser than intended once it dries. And then hair length is the deciding factor. For a simple three-strand braid, you need at least about 10 to 12 centimeters for it to hold.
And from what length can you do
a fishtail braid? I'd say at least shoulder length, preferably longer. It's a completely different technique. With the fishtail, also called the herringbone technique, you only divide the hair into two sections, not three. Then you alternately take a very thin strand from the outside of one section and cross it over to the other. And you repeat that on the other side.
Which creates that typical V pattern.
And the crucial difference from a regular braid, the strands are much finer. The thinner you take them, the more detailed the fishtail pattern becomes. It takes patience. If you're doing it for the first time, you should plan on a good 20 to 30 minutes. The most common mistake is grabbing strands that are too thick because you're getting impatient. But then it just looks like a regular braid and the fishtail effect is lost.
And here we have to be honest. Whether the Vikings used exactly this technique, we don't know. The fishtail braid is often presented today as typically Viking age. But archaeologically, there's no specific evidence for it. What we do know is that the technique is ancient and would have been entirely possible with the means available at the time. Plausible, but not documented.
And then there are the more complex variations. The four-strand braid, for example. You divide the hair into four equal sections. You take the outermost right strand under the one next to it and then over the next one. Then you do the same from the left. The result is a wider, flatter braid with a
an almost ribbon-like appearance.
And when it works for the first time, it's a truly amazing feeling. You fight your way through the first attempts. Your fingers refuse to cooperate. You lose track of which strand goes where. And then suddenly this even pattern emerges and it holds. It's genuinely satisfying.
I can tell that's a moment you don't forget.
And then there's the waterfall braid, which is a category all its own. You take a strand from the front of your head, divide it into three sections, and braid it like a regular braid. But every time you lay the upper strand over the middle one, you let the lower strand simply fall, and instead pick up a new one from the hair underneath. That creates the cascading effect, where loose hair falls through the braid.
And now comes the historical context, which we need to be honest about. Both the four-strand braid and the waterfall braid are only documented as specifically named techniques in modern times. The waterfall braid is essentially a variation of the French braid. That the Vikings used these specific patterns can't be proven. These are techniques that we interpret today in a Viking style. And that's perfectly fine, as long as we acknowledge it for what it is.
What you can say, though, is the basic principles. Laying strands over one another, crossing under and over, picking up new strands. Those aren't highly complicated inventions. They're, well, logical variations of a basic principle. And if you look at textile techniques that are actually documented for the Viking Age, diagonal braiding, for example, there's a fragment from a grave in Birka, 9th century, and also from Orseberg, then you can see that people were very much skilled at complex braiding techniques. Just not on hair, but on textiles. But the dexterity was there.
That's a good bridge. The technical skill was there. And it would be reasonable to assume that similar principles were also applied to hair. But the direct evidence is missing.
As far as practice goes, anyone who wants to try these more complex variations, I'd recommend starting with the simple 3-strand braid until you've really got it down. Then try the fishtail. And only once you're confident with that, tackle the 4-strand braid or the waterfall. And one crucial thing, the hairstyle needs to suit the occasion. In everyday life, whether historical or modern, a simple braid or a fishtail is perfectly sufficient. The more elaborate patterns were probably reserved for special occasions, feasts, ceremonies, assemblies. Though that remains speculation.
And the simplest style also has a very practical advantage. It holds. A well-braided 3-strand braid easily survives a day at a reenactment fair or a LARP battle. A waterfall braid, well, that needs considerably more maintenance.
Let me put it this way. For the fair, go with the simple braid. For the feast in the evening, feel free to bring out the fishtail.
Right, let's bring it all together. Today we've worked through the source material, the social significance, the techniques, and I believe the most important takeaway is Norse braided hairstyles are a topic where you really have to distinguish carefully between what we know and what we wish we knew.
And the exciting thing is, what we know for certain is already fascinating in its own right. The comb finds that frequently turn up in graves, the long-distance trade in reindeer antler just for making combs, that shows how central hair care was in everyday Norse life. It doesn't need any embellishment to be impressive.
And at the same time, the specific hairstyles we perceive today as typically Viking Age are largely modern interpretations. That doesn't make them any less beautiful or less wearable. It just means we should be honest. We take a historical foundation, the high status of hairstyling, the proven braiding expertise in textiles, the few visual depictions, and build on it creatively.
And that's perfectly accepted in the scene. In LARP, you have all the freedom in the world anyway. It's about the look and the experience. In reenactment, people are more cautious, trying to stay as close to the sources as possible. But even there, everyone knows that with hairstyles, a certain degree of interpretation is unavoidable because the evidence simply doesn't allow for anything else.
What personally fascinates me most about this topic is this
connection between something totally mundane and something that defines identity.
Yes, that's it exactly. Doing your hair in the morning is one of the most ordinary things imaginable. And yet, it clearly meant so much to the Vikings that they received combs as grave goods. That they imported raw materials from the Arctic to make proper combs. That Arab travelers like Ibn Fadlan specifically mentioned grooming habits when describing Norsemen. This connection between the everyday and, well, a sense of self, I find that remarkable.
And for everyone who's now itching to try it themselves, just get started. A 3-strand braid, a comb, a hair tie. That's all you need to begin. Then work your way up to the fishtail, to the 4-strand braid. The technique comes with practice, and there's really nothing better than standing at a fair or an event knowing that you styled your own hair.
And maybe archaeology will reveal even more one day. Every new find, every improved analytical method can change our understanding. 10 years ago, we didn't know where the antler for the Hedeby combs came from. Who knows what the next excavations will unearth?
And until then, we'll just do what the Vikings
probably did. Grab a comb, take care of our hair, and make the best of it.
Couldn't have said it better myself. If this topic piqued your interest and you want to dive even deeper into the world of the Vikings, at battlemerchant.com you'll find plenty of inspiration, from the right hair accessories to all kinds of other Viking topics.
And on the blog, there are many more articles for anyone with a passion for history.
And with that, we'll say goodbye for today. Thank you so much for listening.
Until next time, take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.